But right out of the box here in the second hour this afternoon, we are pleased to be joined on the telephone line by an actress who rose to prominence with tremendously popular roles in the 1970s television series Laverne and Shirley, in films like American Graffiti and The Conversation. She's the author of a wonderful memoir that's now out in paperback called Shirley, I Jest, A Storied Life. We are thrilled to be joined by Cindy Williams. Cindy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So much to talk about with you, but let's go back to the beginning and talk about how you you found a home for yourself when you were in high school in a play production class that had some pretty talented people as well as yourself.
Oh, yes, well, that was sort of my first experience with theater, and I had tried out for the talent show, and instead the director of the theater arts department asked me, he said, well, you made it into the talent show, but I think you should think about taking theater arts as an elective. I'll put you straight into play production. And so I said, what the hey? And I did. I was thrilled. And I was in the class with Sally Field, and who was marvelous, but she was in and out of class because she was doing, I believe, The Flying Nun, which I was very jealous of, but even more so when she got the role of Gidget. And then I was green with envy.
After school, you went...
Even then, Rich, she was a marvelous, marvelous actress. At 15, she was brilliant. And it didn't take a Rhodes Scholar to figure that out.
You
brilliant on stage.
You made the decision to study theater in college as well, but it sounds like a really wonderful break and opportunity for you, and something that you remain proud of was that acceptance into the Actors Studio.
Well, that came after I went to Los Angeles City College and enrolled in the theater arts department there. And that was just by happenstance with my good friend, Vern Joyce, who I'd met in the theater arts department at Los Angeles City College. And he had gone to New York and auditioned for the Actors Studio and made it to the final round. But when he made it to the final round, he had moved back to Los Angeles. So he asked me if I would do his final audition scene with him. And I said, sure. So the pressure's off of me, you see. So anyway, so I did the scene with him, and lo and behold, he made it in, and they made me a member also. And it was due mostly to his fine talent and, you know, taking me along with him and just being brilliant in that scene. So, yes, I am a member of the acclaimed Actors Studio.
Now, while you were in L.A., you also got a job because you need something to make the ends meet, pay the bills, and you worked at the Whiskey A Go-Go and had a memorable run-in, well, a lot of famous people, but I especially love the story in your book about Jim Morrison.
You know, Rich, it's very tough to tell this story because I'd have to be, like, there in front of you and the listening audience to act it out. But, yes, I got a job as a cocktail waitress at the Whiskey A Go-Go during the height of, you know, just the height of the 60s and everything that was going on the Sunset Strip there and in L.A. and around the world, actually. And so my first night, they gave me the VIP section to wait, which I was surprised about because only the older, more, you know, schooled, the scholared cocktail waitresses got to serve the VIP section. But they gave it to me, and they said, you know, and the girl said, that's your first table over there. And I walked over, and there was a gentleman who was sitting with his back to me, and there were two blonde girls. I remember they were both blonde, because they both ordered Tom Collins. Both ordered the same drink and both had the same color hair. Anyway, and then I asked the gentleman, I said, and for you, sir, and he turned around and it was Jim Morrison in this light that was like a godly light from heaven upon him. And he looked like a Greek god, and I was stammering, and he said, I'll have a bottle of Jack. and I wrote down bottle of Jack. I took it over to the bartender, Tony, and I put it up, and he said, "What's this bottle of Jack? Is Morrison in the club?" And I said, "Yes, Jim Morrison is in the club." And he said, "Well, he knows perfectly well I can't serve him a bottle at the table. Tell him a single or a double, or that's it." So I had the task of going back to tell Jim Morrison he couldn't have a bottle of Jack on the table. And he said, "Who's tending bar? Is it Tony?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "He served me a bottle of Jack before. He'll serve me a bottle of Jack tonight. Go tell him that." And so I had to go back to Tony. And then he sent me back again. Then they started calling each other names. And I was supposed to carry these messages back and forth until I was in tears. And I said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Morrison, but I cannot serve you a bottle of Jack. I can bring you a double or a single. I'll buy it for you." And he took my hand and he said, "What's your name?" And I said, "Cindy." And he said, "Well, Miss Cindy, we're just playing with you." And I turned around and everyone was laughing at me. All the waitresses, the busboys, Tony, all the bartenders, everyone. And he pranked me. And he said, "I'll take a double." And that was it. And then they sent me up to the peanut gallery. They sent me to a different section. They had only sent me to the VIP section to do that to me, you know. So it was fun. I mean, in the end, it's a great story to tell. But it's a tough story to tell because, as I said, if I was there in front of you, Rich, I'd act it out and it'd be much more colorful.
I'm picturing you acting it out, if that helps.
Okay, it does help.
You'll help
picture me running back and forth and being just terribly upset because I couldn't bring a bottle of Jack Daniels to Jim Morrison's table.
You also made friends very early on with Ed Begley Jr., who wrote the foreword to your book and is right up front about the fact that he always hoped it would be more than friends, but in the long run, it's worked out very well for both of you.
Oh, he's like my little brother. In a way, you know, I mean, his daughter Amanda is my goddaughter, and I'm just, he's like family, and just a wonderful, wonderful actor, wonderful, you know, I mean, just an environmentalist. That's where I basically learned, you know, all of that from. I mean, he used to drive, I saw him coming off a freeway off ramp one time in an electric golf cart, and he had a friend with him, and he picked me up for a date one time. This is when I first met him, in that golf cart, and he just practices what he preaches, and he's got a beautiful home that's off the grid. You know, everything is off the grid. He also came to a party I was giving one night and asked if he could plug his car into my socket in the garage, and I said sure, and he blew all the lights out at the party, everything, that darn electric car. But he was way ahead of the curve, and he's a darling friend of mine, just a fabulous person.
We're talking with Cindy Williams here on Downtown. Well, an early break came when you were cast in the television series Room 222. I love that show. I'm a teacher in my full-time job, and one of the reasons is I was so inspired by that show as a kid. What a great opportunity that was for you as well.
It was my first job, and if memory serves me, it was James Brooks who hired me for that job, and I played that character, Rhoda Zagor. I'll never forget her name, Rhoda Zagor. And I played that character three times, but the first time was on an episode that I believe won an Emmy. I think it was called The Substitute Teacher. I'm not sure, but because I only remember me, of course. But and it was my very first job, and so they also played a prank on me on that show. But it was a a historic show because it had, and I'm going to forget their names, but it had the principal and one of the teachers were black actors, and it was one of the first shows that ever had, you know, actors who are African American as the lead.
Right, Lloyd Haynes.
But you know what? It didn't matter. I mean, you just saw no. You didn't go on the show and say, "Gee, there's black actors here." It was like just this show that was just wonderful, and every actor on the show was sublime. And but it was that show that had, you know, two of the first African American actors be leads.
Lloyd Haynes and Denise Nicholas.
Exactly. Thank you. Thank you, Rich.
That's why I'm here. It's what I do.
They were fantastic people to work with, just so encouraging and lovely, and just wonderful actors.
You got the role in a film being made by George Lucas, the role of Laurie Henderson in American Graffiti, and I was surprised to learn that was not the role you wanted.
No, I wanted Candy Clark's role of Debbie, bad girl, you know, the risque girl. And then that was already cast when I was offered the part of Laurie. So then I said, well, what about Carol? And the casting director, who was Fred Roos, said, well, Carol is a 12-year-old. And I said, I'll put braces on, and I could do it. And he goes, well, believe it or not, Cindy, I've actually cast a 12-year-old to play a 12-year-old. So anyway, and all's well that ends well, because it was a fantastic film and just an incredible experience. And I played the girl who cries the entire night.
I love that movie so much. But you also made another movie not long after that that for some reason people don't talk about as much. I think it's one of the great movies of the 70s, and that's The Conversation. That was such an incredible film.
Yes. Francis Ford Coppola wrote it and directed it, of course, and that was monumental for me. And it was a brilliant, brilliant script, brilliant movie, and I was so fortunate to be in it. And they referred to it as that little movie Francis did in between Godfather.
Right.
And he did. He did it in between Godfather 1 and 2, and that was a movie that he made. And it was just fantastic. I was so blessed to be in that film.
You mentioned Fred Roos, and you had signed up to work with Fred Roos and Gary Marshall as reps for you. And we've talked to so many people from Henry Winkler to Don Most to Anson Williams, and all of them, Michael McKean, all have talked about what an incredible influence Gary Marshall was, not just on their career, but his people, that it was like going to school being around him.
Well, he was methodical in always wanting to be cohesive with a family. And I don't want to say morality, but it was like a family. It was like the golden rule. He always wanted that to be present. I mean, he didn't put it like that, but there always had to be a thought process of why the characters came to the at the end of the piece, if they tried to do something. For instance, Penny and I, Laverne and Shirley, get a rebate on their gas bill, and they find out that it's a mistake. So they question, should they spend the money or shouldn't they spend the money? And so that's Gary's doing that. At the end, we talk to each other about how right it was of us to give the money back, and that had we spent the money and kept it for, you know, for ourselves, you know, that wouldn't have been right. But we did it in comedic terms, you know, on a comedy level. And he was a genius at that. And that was always something he wanted questioned. Like, I don't wear fur. And on this show we did where we were diving for dollars, I forget what it was called, but we get on this game show and we almost win a fur coat and a trip to, you know, a cruise and all this money. And in the end, we finally lose. And I had said to Gary, I just don't want to have to put that fur coat on. I don't want to put it on because I'm so against wearing fur. And he said, all right, I'll write you a line. So he wrote me a line where at the end we're discussing how we were kind of greedy wanting to win that show and we'd do anything to win it, and how it might have been best that we didn't win. And I said, I was willing to wear the fur of an animal. I forget. It was a funny line. But I said, and that, I was so greedy, I was willing to wear the fur of an innocent animal. And Gary wrote that for me. And so he always had an eye on what good and bad, and that goodness in a person should always trump the bad in that person. And that's how and if you watch Happy Days or any of his television shows, it's always good versus, it's always good wins out. And he always kept an eye on that, along with being just a phenomenal comedy writer.
I was surprised to learn.
Always kept an eye on that.
I was surprised to learn, Cindy, they were reluctant to let you get involved in a lot of the physical comedy in the first season of the show.
Well, this goes back to playing Laurie, to every, even when I was on Room 222, I played the character that, the lead's best friend. He said, what's the matter, Jeannie? He didn't mean to leave you. I'm sure he still likes you. And then in American Graffiti, crying, all the time. And so they never saw me as a comedian, I don't think. And so the first two seasons, of the show, I had to fight for that. And really fight for it. And they knew Penny could do it because they'd been on Odd Couple with her and because she's Gary's sister. But I kept going to Gary and saying, give me a chance. I can do physical comedy too. I'm very agile. Look. Anyway, he finally one day he came to me and he said, we're going to write you something and it's going to be physical and we'll see how you do. And then, take it from there. So they wrote me this thing where we're doing our house cleaning, and Penny gets the vacuum cleaner stuck on her lip because she's taking it off, and she's just got the tube there, and she gets it stuck on her lip, and all it said in the script was, Shirley pulls it off. Shirley helps her get it off her, her mouth. And so I just came up with all the physical things to do there. And I think I ended up putting my foot on her chest and pulling. I'm not sure. But after that, Gary said, okay, you proved it to us. We'll start writing new physical comedy along with Penny to do. And that's sort of how it became a two-person physical show.
I think people might be surprised to learn that you were great friends as well with the late Andy Kaufman.
Oh, yes, Andy. Yes. What can I say? It's all there. I had seen him on Saturday Night Live and just thought he was brilliant. I couldn't take my eyes off of him. And he was playing the congas and doing that funny thing where he cries while he's singing, kind of. And I remember I was in a room of all my, I was in an acting class, and we were having an after-class party, and Saturday Night Live was on. And I said, look at this guy. Everybody, come here and look. And I remember them all gathering around and all watched Andy. And then I met him at the Improv one night, and he asked me if I could give him a ride home, and I said, sure. And then we became friends, and then he started asking me if I'd like go to, if I was in New York, I'd go to Caroline's go to Caroline's and do a midnight show with him. And it's all in the book where he doesn't tell me what he's going to do. He just tells me what he wants me to do on stage. And then I realize as I'm standing there that he's doing something that could possibly have the audience turn on us both. It was an honor to get to work with him. And I also did his special that he had on ABC. And I just got him. Like most people that get him, it's just a real different take on things. But it does make you happy. He just made people happy, and it snuck up on you. And I just loved, he was so marvelous. And so, and one time he came over to my house, and that character that he did, that obnoxious character.
Tony Clifton.
And he refused. He was dressed like him, and I've never seen Tony Clifton before. And he came to the door, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he had this funny mustache on, and he was, you know, ordering me around and telling me to put the... I had a cat at the time, and telling me that cat staring at him, put that cat in the other room. I said, "Andy, what are you doing?" And he kept saying, "Refer to me as Tony. I'm Tony." And so it got me so upset that I finally ended up pulling his hair and saying, you better be Andy. Anyway, that's in the book. That's tough. I'd have to be in front of you again and show you what I meant by what went on there. But I finally got him out of that character. But it went on for hours before I, you know, got him. He said, What do you want? When I grabbed his hair at the temple because somebody told me if someone ever accosts you, grab their hair at the temple when full. So I did, and he said, okay, what do you want? And I said, be Elvis. And he pops up and he goes, well, hello, little lady. Like that, and he was Elvis. Anyway, it was a most marvelous most marvelous adventures I had with Andy Kaufman.
Wonderful,
and a sweetheart of a person, and just an incredible entertainer, comic, you know, comedian.
You returned to the stage and have traveled all around the country doing shows, but how big a thrill was it to make your Broadway debut in The Drowsy Chaperone?
Oh, my goodness, that was a dream come true. That was... you know, everything that if you study theater and you you're on stage in college and then you take classes, the whole aim is to make it to Broadway or the London stage, but Broadway. And then I did. And of course, with my luck, IOPSI was on strike, and so I couldn't rehearse. And and they closed the show 3 weeks after I started doing the show, because the IOPSI strike had, you know, really maimed the show as far as business was concerned. But I got to be, I call it my 3 weeks on Broadway, and I don't write about that in the book because I hadn't done it yet.
Right. Cindy, it's such a treat to talk with you. We've enjoyed your work for so many years. We thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me on, Rich. It's been my pleasure, believe me.
Well, hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving and a Merry Christmas, and perhaps we'll catch up with you again down the road.
Thank you, Rich. Happy Thanksgiving and Merry Christmas.
Cindy Williams with us here on Downtown.